From the University of Utah, Secrets of the Campus Cadavers. I'm Paul Gabrielson. Episode 3, The Remains. This is the Rio Grande Depot in Salt Lake City. This stately building dates back to 1910. As the rail hub for the Denver and the Rio Grande Western Railroad, it's a part of Salt Lake's history. Arriving immigrants and departing World War II soldiers passed through the building through the first half of the 20th century. It's only fitting that the building now houses the Utah State Historical Society. Off the cavernous lobby is a research library with warm woods and the rich smell of old paper. Through a door, another door, and another door, and you're in Darina Kopp's lab. Here is where the bones have been brought. They were found in April 2016 at a construction site at the University of Utah. Now they're here, laid out carefully on tables covered in brown paper. Each bone is neatly labeled, with masking tape marking the groupings of different bone types. There are clearly recognizable long bones, ribs, feet, and a few skulls, several jaws, each with only a few teeth. Many pieces are just fragments. Kopp's job as the Utah State forensic anthropologist is to turn these fragments into a story.
There's so much that we can learn from looking at skeletal remains of individuals, whether they're 4 or 5 years old, you know, a recent modern person, or whether they're 5,000 years old. We can learn so much about the life of that person by looking at their bones.
It's a working laboratory, but it's also a place of respect. Photos would be inappropriate. There's a feeling of reverence and quiet.
And it actually gets me rather upset when people think about, you know, oh, bones are so cool. I think they're so cool. I'm like, yeah, they're cool, but they're a person. And you have to always remember that that was somebody that was just like you and me, and we have to treat them with the same respect that we would want to be treated with, or we would want our grandparents or our loved ones to be treated with.
One of her first tasks when looking at the remains found at the U is to determine the minimum number of individuals represented in the collection.
So in this case, we had 11 right proximal femurs. So that's the ball of the ball and socket of your hip joint. And we had 11 of those that were on the right side. And we know that each person only has one right proximal femur. So if we have 11 of those, we know we have at least 11 people that were represented by this set of remains.
Then she needs to determine which bones might have belonged to the same person. That's based on the principle of articulation, or how well the bones fit together.
When I'm teaching this to undergraduates and graduate students, I actually say, what you need to remember is the foot bone attaches to the ankle bone attaches to the shin bone, and the shin bone attaches to the thigh bone.
Some other clues: symmetry between bones from the right and left sides of the body, staining on bones that result from the circumstances of the burial. In this case, she can tell that the cadavers, when they were buried, still had flesh attached. In addition to figuring out how the bones fit together, though, she also had to figure out how they were taken apart. It was immediately apparent that the remains were anatomical cadavers, used for dissection by medical students. She recognized the marks of saws and chisels.
And so I wanted to, you know, I know what the modern processes of anatomy are, but I wanted to see how they might be different or changed in the early 1900s. And so I went to the Internet Archive, and I just did a search for an early anatomy text. And the one that I picked up on was actually called Holden's Anatomy, and it was published in right around the turn of the century in 1901.
Kopp is going to describe how that textbook instructed students in dissection procedures. For comparison, you'll also hear Carrie Peterson. He's the director of the body donor program at the University of Utah, and he'll describe how students perform the procedure now. Fair warning, they're going to talk about dissecting human bodies. If that kind of thing isn't for you, you might want to skip the rest of this episode. Still with us? The first procedure is removing the calvaria, or the top of the skull, to gain access to the brain.
And they, you know, they talked about using the saw and sawing, you know, around the right above the ears.
We circumscribe or draw a line around the bone, and we take a It's a cast cutting saw. They're also known as bone saws. It oscillates, and then we cut along that line.
But not sawing all the way through the bone, because you could cut the dura and you could cut into the soft tissue inside. And so then what the anatomy text suggested was, once you get to, you know, almost through the bone, you use a fine chisel.
We take a chisel and a mallet, and we crack that inner surface of bone to be able to lift the calvary off without destroying or damaging the brain in any way.
And on these calvaria samples, we could see that.
The next procedure is called a laminectomy.
This was really interesting because what it is, it's called a laminectomy. So the lamina are if you think about the bumps down the middle of your back, those are your spinous processes. And on each side of them are the lamina. They're kind of like little plates that connect your spinous processes to the round part or the body of your vertebra.
What we're doing when we cut through the lamina is we hope to expose the spinal cord itself.
Bend the back of the person so it's bent, and then it's a saw that's not a straight saw, it's more of a curved saw.
We take that same autopsy or bone saw, and we cut through these lamina from top to as far down as we can go.
Once we got this spinal column back together, we could definitely see, you know, how they did it and how they were, you know, they went, the cuts matched up from the upper to the lower vertebra.
Looking at the curriculum the U Medical School used at the time and the remains found reveals an exact correlation. Here's Kate Hovanes from SWCA, the archaeological firm that excavated the remains. Hovanes is a historian. She scoured records to lend some context to the story. As part of her research, she found lists of courses from the medical school's early days.
The spine, which matches up with anatomy class number 4, which is the head, neck, and spinal column. Similarly, the fact that we found feet might relate to anatomy 2, which was the lower extremity. But just usually we don't get as close correspondence as that. Usually it's a little more speculative, but that just going, I guess that probably matches up pretty nicely is an unusual experience with history.
So the bones tell us that anatomical dissection hasn't changed much in the past 100 years. We can see those procedural clues. But the bones also tell more personal stories about people's lives.
Another one that really actually touched me quite a bit was a hand that we had.
Touch the bones on the back of your hand. They're straight. The bones on this hand are smashed, broken, bent, and warped.
The individual had some sort of horrific, probably crushing injury to their hand. And the fact that they were deformed when they healed really showed me that they, you know, this person, you know, couldn't keep the hand immobilized all the time, so it wasn't cast like we think when we get broken bones now. If someone had such a crushing hand injury like that today, they would definitely have multiple hand surgeries, and they would have fine screws and plates and everything in their hand to reconstruct it. You know, you just look at it and you can see the pain and suffering that this person went through.
It's a dramatic example of the things the bones can teach us about the people they belong to. There are others here, too. There's a set of forearm bones with a partially healed break called a perifracture.
It has long been identified as a possible fracture that is caused by a defensive posture. If somebody's being hit, or especially their head, about their head, they're being hit, they might put their arms up to protect their head. And when you do that, when you put either your right or left arm up to protect your head, the ulna is the bone that is facing outwards, facing towards your possible aggressor. And often you would think if someone's falling and trying to break a fall, you would most likely see both bones fractured or have some sort of injury. But this individual just had their ulna fractured. And so, again, it's suggestive to me that this individual was probably trying to block blows in a defensive mechanism. It was what we call antemortem, which means it happened before the person died, but it wasn't completely healed. And so that lets me know it happened not a few weeks before the person died, but could be a few months before the person died.
Kopp says that many of the bones showed signs of arthritis.
There are very high levels of osteoarthritis, especially for the age. We have younger individuals, people in their 20s and 30s, who have very high levels of osteoarthritis. And we have older individuals with very severe osteoarthritis. Older individuals would be, you know, in their 50s and 60s. So that lets me know that these people were doing a high amount of activity, probably labor, especially based on the amounts and the types of arthritis we see in some of the joints. These were workers. These weren't people who sat at home all day long. You know, they were out either in the field or in the mines or in the factories, working every single day.
We have a few other details. As far as Kopp can tell, all of the bones belonged to men. One, possibly, was an older teenager. It's amazing how much we can learn about these people from their bones. Without a name, without any record of any other detail of their lives, we know that they were probably laborers, maybe with hard lives and not much access to medical care. Their life histories, their hardships and pains, their growth are all preserved in their bones. They've told us part of their life story without uttering a word. It's likely that the medical students who dissected these cadavers learned all of this and more about the bodies they worked with. So what else can medical students learn from a human body? That's coming next time on Secrets of the Campus Cadavers. This podcast is a production of University of Utah Marketing and Communications, produced, written, and edited by Paul Gabrielson and Brooke Adams. Find other podcasts in this series at unews.utah.edu/cadavers. Web assistance by David White and Scott Troxel. Marketing assistance by Colin Barrett and Jason Jung. Our music is Procession by Puddle of Infinity. Special thanks to Christopher Nelson, Maria O'Mara, Lindsay Kester, Alice Whitaker, and Bethany Gabrielson. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the University of Utah or its administration.